Welcome to Curmudgeon's Corner. As I'm recording this, it's, once again, it's late in the week. It is Friday, April 12th, 2013. I'm Sam Minter, and guess what? No Yvonne, as is often the case when it's this late. And again, I didn't have time to, go look for a co-host or anything, because this is one of those situations where every day we thought we were going to do it. We were going to do it Sunday evening, Monday UTC, and something came up, and then we were going to do it the next day, and something came up, and then we were going to do it the next day, and something came up. Eventually it fell through for the last time. But, it was too late for me to, put out an email saying, hey, does anybody else want to co-host the show for me or anything? But, I would do that if I knew, days in advance that Yvonne wouldn't be here. But when we just do this kind of constantly thinking it's going to happen, but it doesn't, it's much harder to do that. In any case, that means you got me, and you got me by myself. And so here we go. Got a few topics. We'll talk a little bit about Facebook Home. The gun control thing has been heating up again, and we haven't really talked about it, for months. I'll talk about gun control for a little bit. Of course, North Korea is continuing to, make threatening statements. We'll see where we are at that point. I've got a number of other, random things to maybe mention, but, we'll see. We'll see. Let me get started on Facebook Home. Facebook announced in the last week plus or so, what their new thing would look like. And everybody's been having rumors about a Facebook phone or whatever for forever. And what appears to be happening, at least for the time being, is that what they announced is not a quote unquote Facebook home phone, not something that's going to go head to head against Apple and Samsung and other manufacturers like that. But instead, it's a software layer on top of Android. And really, it's only a replacement for the launch screen and a little bit to help with to replace the messaging portion of things. And you can get it on a bunch of different Android phones going forward. Not all, because it does have some integration into the system that makes it more complicated than, hey, here's something that'll work on all Android. You can get it in a handful of phones, and there are going to be a couple that ship with it out of the box. And I guess the first one's called the HTC First, which, okay, whatever. There's a name. Excuse me. but it's also going to be on the HTC One, the One X, the Galaxy S3, the S4, the Galaxy Note 2, blah, blah, blah. The main idea of this is it replaces the lock screen and the launcher, so that it's chock full of Facebook content. And then you can still, get past that to your regular apps and things like that, but it makes Facebook front and center to your phone. And the basic idea here is the notion that, hey, rather than making your experience around apps, let's make your experience around people and the people you interact with. Therefore, you pick up your phone and boom, immediately you're seeing updates from your friends. And yes, of course, eventually they'll insert ads there too. It makes chatting with your friends easier. They integrate the Facebook Messenger with regular SMS, and the biggest innovation here, I guess, is they have an interface where if you're in the middle of something in some other app and a message comes up, you can sort of do your texting interaction with that person in an overlay without actually leaving the app you're in and going to some messaging app, which that actually sounds pretty cool. And so there's two aspects of this. Of course, one is this going to be a success? I don't have my crystal ball with me today, but here's my immediate thought. The Uber geeks like myself, who already utilize their phones fully and to the max, are not going to like this that much, because Facebook isn't necessarily the center of our interactions with our phones. We have all kinds of stuff we want to do with it. And this sort of, I would find this incredibly annoying to, because I would see it most of the time as an extra layer I had to get through in order to get to the stuff that I want to get to. Now, I admit, I check Facebook a couple times a day on my phone. But I would be annoyed if it was omnipresent. However, and this is the big however, for a lot of the kinds of folks who aren't fully utilizing their phone, who aren't, downloading dozens and dozens of apps and using all of them on a regular basis, who instead are just going into their carrier's store and saying, what's the latest cool phone I should get? And having whatever Android they have handed to them. If this was pre-installed and sort of explained to them as, this comes with the Facebook interface, they might find this, they might not think twice about it. Oh, this is just how it works. Oh, cool. All my Facebook stuff is right here. And maybe what they're doing on Facebook is a significant portion of what they're doing anyway, or they don't mind if it is. These are people who probably just wanted a freaking phone and would have been fine with a feature phone. But hey, you put Facebook front and center, and that's kind of nice. So maybe it'll be a success in those groups. And of course, I think that's where Facebook won't, a push, to make sure those folks are, maximizing their Facebook interaction is something that Facebook would be quite happy about. They're not necessarily concerned about, like I said, the Uber geeks, because, frankly, we all check Facebook anyway, or most of us do. The fact that it's not front and center isn't going to change that much for us. But the folks who have sort of, this can just potentially increase some usage. It gets you more integrated into the Facebook world. It gets it in front of you more often. And of course, this lets them collect much more data from you, which is valuable to them in all kinds of different ways. So we'll see how that works out. Obviously they haven't made this available for iPhone, and the way iPhone works wouldn't let you unless it was jailbroken. excuse me, still have a cough many months later. I thought I was over it, but no. Even if I had an Android, I would see myself testing this, downloading it, seeing how it worked, but I have a hard time imagining myself keeping it. But that doesn't mean it's not going to have a significant following out there. But I think the key really here is going to be for devices that ship with this pre-installed as the default, as opposed to people downloading it and making it their default. I mean, they've made that possible on a number of different phones. But I think that'll be a less common vector for this. Now, of course, the second part of this is just the continuing trend that Yvonne and I have talked about a lot over the last few months, which is this is yet another example of someone taking the work that Google has done on Android and doing something else with it. Either forking it and making something completely different, or in this case, sort of replacing the core experience of launching and getting to your apps and things like that. And these are all things that are potentially letting other companies take advantage of the work that Google has done for free in ways that make it less likely that Google is going to profit from it. At some point, Google is going to have to, at some point, it seems like this is something that Google is going to have to figure out a way to deal with. It seems unsustainable. Perhaps I'm wrong. Perhaps Google is absolutely happy having, you know, dozens of companies do this kind of thing while they sort of maintain the pure Android that's under the covers and put out a few phones that have a more pure Google experience. And meanwhile, maybe they get some data collection advantages out of it, even if sort of all the Google stuff is buried. Not sure. But it certainly seems to be not quite what their plan had been, which was that, or at least it seemed to be, that they'd put all this stuff out for free, but the core Google elements would be so closely tied to the phone that, of course, all of, you know, the people using Android would keep them there, and so they'd be making, you know, money off of people using Google services and Google ads and things like this. And it just doesn't seem like that plan is coming together quite the way they'd expected. But, you know, there might be more thoughts that are in there that are different than is immediately obvious. But I think this trend has to be a concern to Google. Yeah, obviously, like I said, there's different degrees of this. There's putting the home screen in front of it. There's heavily customized versions of Android. And then, of course, this completely forking Android and saying, okay, thanks for the head start, Google. Now we're going to do something else with it. Google can't be happy about that. Anyway, let's take a break. Let's see. What should we dive into? We'll go ahead and talk about gun control when we come back. We'll be back after this message. This is Sam here with an opportunity for you. Yes, you heard me right. An opportunity. For you loyal listeners of Curmudgeon's Corner, you know, every once in a while, Yvonne can't make a show. And I do a solo show, which, you know, I think I do okay. But, you know, it's always interesting to have a second person to bounce off. And just in general, sometimes it's good to hear another voice. If you, yes, you, have some things to say about the kinds of things we usually talk about on Curmudgeon's Corner, you know, politics, current events, news, tech, then drop me a line at abelsmay@abelsmay.com letting me know. And, hey, I'll keep you in mind. And maybe ask if you can join us sometime, either on a regular show with Yvonne, if it's something particularly pressing that you maybe have an expertise on, or just, you know, hey, an opportunity to co-host when Yvonne is out. Who knows? Now, I am not guaranteeing that if you send me an email, you'll definitely get on the show, but let me know if you're interested, and I'll keep you in mind. Thanks, and now, back to the show. And yes, here I am. So before we get into gun control, actually there had been some feedback this last week, so I just wanted to get that out there. We had a couple comments via Twitter from a BYU fan, who's Bruce, who joined us on the show a few times a few months ago. Two things here. Reacting to things in previous shows. One, Yvonne had been talking about his wife wanting to paint their house white. And so he passed along Mr. Bean demonstrating a very efficient way to paint a room white. Goes to a YouTube video of a Mr. Bean episode or show. If you go to YouTube and just search on Mr. Bean painting, it'll be like the first thing that comes up. So take a look at that. Something similar to what Yvonne and I had in mind, I guess. And second, we were talking about Google and sort of the losing trust and not sort of staying true to its original vision, et cetera, et cetera. And he points out an example of a successful web company that has stayed true to itself, its customers, its mission, Craigslist. He also adds RIP newsletters, newspapers. And of course, yeah, Craigslist has been an example of a company that is very similar to what it did originally. It hasn't changed a lot, and people love it. I would say that, you know, this is an example of one that maybe has resisted change a little bit too much. You know, last I looked at Craigslist, it still had, you know, this, the interface is, let's say, not as friendly as it could be. I mean, it's very, you know, plain to the point, whatever, and that has a lot of advantages. But I know every time I've tried to use it, I've felt like there were deficiencies and things that could be made better that aren't necessarily about, you know, adding banner ads or making it a lot prettier, but just, you know, a little bit of modernization and innovation. But, you know, I honestly, I haven't used it that much, and the people who do use it love it. So you can't say too much to that, and they've been successful, and they've, you know, continuing, and they've resisted all kinds of temptations to, I don't know, to sort of go public and change everything and get really, really huge, really fast, and blah, blah, blah. They've been like, okay, we've got our thing. We're going to do our thing, and we're going to continue, and we're satisfied with that. And I do give that a lot. And also, of course, you know, and of course, it's a completely different world, but I'd also hold out the Wikipedia model, which, of course, is a nonprofit. But that's another example of something where, you know, hey, that they could have long ago decided to commercialize, give up being a nonprofit, and that site probably could have made tons and tons of money. It probably would have lost its soul in doing so, to use a metaphor, because you could see all kinds of conflicts of interest if there were paid interests on Wikipedia. So I'm very glad it stayed the way it has. but of course, very much, you know, it's a different mindset. It's like, we're not in this to, you know, get rich fast. We're in this to create a good service, and we're going to make that service as good as possible. And in Wikipedia's case, they're just trying to, you know, make enough money to keep the thing running through donations. In the case of Craigslist, they obviously do want to make money, but they've been content to sort of say, you know, here's our core thing. Here's what we do. We're going to do it. We're going to do it well. And we're not going to get distracted by other things. And we'll make whatever money we make. And in the process, of course, as Bruce said, you know, put newspapers out of business. that's not, of course, the only thing affecting newspapers. But killing classified ad revenue essentially was a little bit of a blow to many newspapers. Anyway, thanks for the feedback, Chris, I'm, you know, my mind is just going, thanks for the feedback, Bruce. Okay. Gun control. So I had made the prediction, on our prediction show at the beginning of the year, that what was going to happen in gun control, there'd be a lot of back and forth, there's been a lot of blah, 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 and in the end, they will pass something, because they want to be able to say they did something. But that something wouldn't necessarily be anything that actually made a significant difference. And I think we're well on the way to do that. It has yet to be seen whether we'll actually get anything passed and signed by the president. There's still a few steps to go between here and there. But, you know, in this last week, we've had Republican and Democratic senators coming together on a potential deal. We've had the initial cloture votes allowing move to debate happen and pass so that the debate is happening. And we'll see where we go. But it's certainly looking like we're not, you know, if anything comes out of this, it's going to follow my predictions. Now, let me start with a couple things. First of all, I've said when Yvonne and I did last speak about gun control, I don't have any particular love for guns. I don't hold the Second Amendment as sacred. I think, you know, it's a just like, you know, a lot of the Constitution, hey, it's worked pretty well, but, you know, hey, it could be changed. It's not one of the principles I hold central to, you know, my political philosophy. Like, I'd say the principles embodied in the First Amendment, not the First Amendment itself as written, but the basic notion of freedom of thought and freedom of speech, for instance, is absolutely core to my notion of what should be true politically. The right to bear arms is not. I understand the value of that in a lot of conceptual ways, in terms of, especially, and this is what I'd said before, I really don't buy any of the arguments for gun ownership that are around, you know, hunting or self-defense or anything like that. The only argument that ever resonated with me at all is the whole idea that, hey, at some point you might need to overthrow the government. But I think that the reality of our world today is that, you know, having small arms is, A, not going to accomplish that goal against the U.S. government. You'd have to expand the notion of the Second Amendment to include, you know, artillery and fighter jets and nuclear weapons and the whole deal. And even more to the point, things have moved to, if we really and truly got to the point where that was necessary, there'd be so many changes in society and so many, you know, the way this would happen is that you'd have people in the military who had access to all these weapons defecting and becoming part of the resistance and stuff like that. It is no longer a really strong argument for private ownership of these things. It's only an argument that just ends up with your crazy militia types, you know, holding out in the wilderness in Montana and such. So I don't really honestly personally buy many of the pro-gun arguments. However, I recognize that a significant part of the country, gun ownership and gun sports are a significant part of the culture, and I don't have a desire to, you know, sort of quote unquote go after them. And also, in general, I default towards less government regulation being better, unless there's a compelling reason not to. However, having said all this, I see the arguments for regulating guns as stronger than the arguments for regulating cars, or at least equivalent to the arguments for regulating cars. In either case, it's a machine that private individuals own and use that can be excessively dangerous when used improperly, when used maliciously, or even when used properly and there are conditions outside your control. And so I certainly see, to me, I don't rail every day against the regulations on cars. Every once in a while when I'm feeling in a philosophical mood, I'm like, driver's licenses, why should we have them? And shouldn't we just, like, you know, have laws against people doing bad things with their cars, don't have driver's licenses, don't have insurance requirements, don't have this, just, you know, if something goes wrong, then deal with it then, after the fact. And yes, sometimes I have those kinds of thoughts and think, yeah, maybe we could do without all of that layer of stuff. But at the same time, I don't wake up every day railing at the fact that, you know, cars are regulated. And I think it's perfectly reasonable that the same or greater level of regulation would exist for guns as exists for cars. And that translates into insurance requirements, that translates into registration, that translates into all sorts of laws about what you have to do when you transfer ownership of a car. It translates into driver's licenses. It translates into lots of regulations about safety in the vehicle itself and all kinds of things. And I think it would be perfectly reasonable to apply all of that kind of stuff to gun ownership as well. Anyway, having said that, when you start looking at the proposals for gun control, what I said is, look, I'm all about practicality here and evaluating these things on actual effectiveness. And the worst possible outcome is adding layers and layers and layers of bureaucracy with no actual discernible effect, or potentially even with negative effect. Because what you're doing is you are doing all of that restriction of people's freedoms. And I can see that being worth it if it has a significant positive effect. Like, for instance, going back to the car example, it has been shown time after time that the safety measures that have been put into cars have had, in fact, a very significant result in the reduction of automobile fatalities. Having seatbelts, having seatbelt laws, More to the point than the laws, changing the culture so that by default people tend to put on their seatbelts and airbags and all of this has had a remarkable effect. Drunk driving laws have had a remarkable effect in bringing down fatalities. The increased safety in cars, again, remarkable effect. So there's something very measurable there that comes out of that. And yes, you give up a little bit of freedom, but it has a measurable positive effect in exchange. For the gun laws that have been on the table, that's less clear. And so let's look. One of the ones that is dead now, or it seems to be dead anyway, is an actual assault weapons ban, motivated by the fact that assault weapons were used in the shooting in Connecticut and several other shootings recently. This is one from the beginning that I've said this is probably concentrating in the wrong place. If you remember the post I made right after the Sandy Hook events, people concentrate on these anomalous high death count single events. The guy comes in there and kills a bunch of kids. But if you look at the overall situation, that is a tiny, tiny fraction of the violent deaths that occur in the U.S., and of course the violent deaths caused by guns, which are, I forget the exact fraction off the top of my head, but I'm going to say between a third and a half of violent deaths. Again, I apologize, I forget the number, but a significant portion of violent deaths in the United States occur with guns as part of the equation. Those type of events, those mass shootings, are a tiny, tiny fraction. Most gun deaths are between people who know each other. Well, the biggest single fraction is actually suicides. But then between people who know each other. In the last week, there have been a couple reports of, you know, toddlers picking up guns and shooting people, you know. And I have a 3-year-old, you know, I would be terrified if I had a gun in the house, regardless of what protections I took, because they just don't know what they're doing yet. So there are all kinds of, the concentrating on these mass shootings, even if you succeed in reducing mass shootings, is a misdirection of effort because you're not concentrating on where the problem really is. You know, the problem is the guy who gets mad and shoots his wife. The problem is, it is almost always one-off shootings. That is by far the majority of gun violence. And yes, you've got gang violence and other things too, but you know, but one-on-one is the majority. So if you're doing something that's concentrating on these high visibility, multiple casualty events, you're concentrating on the wrong thing. And I recognize how those are much more visible and people get much more worked up about it. But in the end, and this goes back to my post about this in December, 20 people killed separately is not less important than 20 people killed together. You know, it's less visible, but you got 20 people dead either way. So you're concentrating on the wrong thing if you concentrate on mass casualties. So anyway, and of course, there was an assault weapon ban in effect, I guess, during the Clinton administration. Results were quite noticeably mixed. Yeah, I've seen a number of analyses on on how well that assault weapon ban worked. And I think the bottom line is it's unclear. There's some metrics and some studies that seem to have shown there was some improvement. There are other metrics that show, oh, not really. And of course, it's all against the background of a much longer trend of reduction in violent death in America. So it's hard to know what was, you know, caused by that particular policy versus something else. But I think you could certainly say there isn't clear evidence that it worked. And even if it did work, once again, you're dealing with a very, very small portion of the violent death incidents caused by these weapons. So it's not really the place to go. So I have no... I'm not too concerned about the fact that the assault weapons ban, you know, appears to be somewhat dead. And I have no real concern either for the same reasons that the ban on large clips seems to be dead. Again, those seem to me to be trying to address the wrong problem. What is left is background checks and expanding background checks. The bill as currently being looked at in Congress, and a number of people have pointed out, by the way, that at this stage, as of when I am recording this, there isn't actually a bill yet. There isn't actual, like, the words haven't been written for the actual bill. There's just people talking about the outlines of it, and the actual language has yet to fully come together. But what's being talked about is basically, right now, you have to have background checks if you go and buy your gun at an actual gun shop. This is expanding it to sales at gun shows and over the internet. But there's still lots of exemptions. If you're doing a private sale to a friend, that doesn't count. And of course, the black market, you know, will always be exempt. Well, not exempt. That's the wrong way to put it. There will always be people who flaunt the law, regardless. And that's true of any law. And it of course has been pointed out that a very high percentage of people who commit crimes with guns don't buy them through legal channels anyway. And so let's see, what's example here? I'm looking at an article by Ezra Klein and Evan Soltis, published April 12th, Is this watered down, overcompromised, possibly ineffective gun control still better than nothing, or bill better than nothing? I made up the still part. And they quote a survey from 2004 of prisoners who'd been locked up for gun crimes, who asked how they got their firearms. Just about 40% said family or friends, and just about another 40% said the street or black market suppliers. Now, keep in mind, people who are in jail for gun crimes is itself a small subset of, you know, people responsible for shooting incidents. excuse me. But in any case, they're closing up a few places where previously you could do a gun transaction without a background check, adding it to a few places, but with a couple big exceptions in there as part of, you know, the compromises needed to get it done. And then there is also more stronger restrictions, I guess. They're making it a felony, essentially, to buy a gun for someone else who you know would fail the background check. And putting potentially some teeth behind that, although there's still a lot of back and forth on exactly what that rule would be, and is it just buying a gun for someone else, or do you actually have to know with no uncertainty that they would fail the background check if they took it? excuse me again. Anyway, so I don't have any objections to the background checks. That should be obvious from how I introduced this segment on guns. I don't have any problem with a registry of gun owners and weapons, so that theoretically every weapon was tied to a person. I don't actually have a problem with those, despite the fact that it introduces a federal bureaucracy and has, you know, government keeping track of things. I really look at it no different than the automobile situation. And again, maybe in an ideal world it wouldn't exist, but if there are benefits and trade-offs, I don't mind so much, as long as those benefits and trade-offs exist and are real. And I think this is right in the zone where it's unclear. I think this probably is still beneficial. It raises the bar a little bit to gun ownership, and yes, anybody. The bottom line is anybody who wants a gun will still be able to get a gun. None of this will stop that. You'll always be able to go to an illegal source. You'll always be able to find someone who will buy the gun for you. There'll be people who can steal guns. None of this will stop that, but it will add additional roadblocks. And yes, some of those roadblocks will deter people who legally could get guns. They just don't want to go through the hassle. And I don't see that as bad. I don't see that as any more bad than the things we do to deter people from smoking. You know, for the most part, I see guns as a public health hazard. And I think changing the culture, like the ideal way for me in terms of how I think about it to deal with guns is not actually by legislation, but is through over time changing the culture so far less people want them. And yes, you'll still get the criminals, but you'll eliminate a lot of the accidentals and a lot of the impulse shootings and things like that. And I think that's a good thing over time. And if you change the culture over time, as opposed to doing it by laws, then, people are still, you're not restricting people's freedoms. You're just changing what they want to do with those freedoms in the first place. And I think in general, that's a much better approach. But again, I think having an extra hoop in place that anybody who really wants it can get through the hoop, except those people who really shouldn't. They have a felony history, or they do have mental stability issues or whatever. I think that's fine. People who really want the guns, they can still get them. You're never going to stop the criminal folks from doing what they do, but you do sort of you make it a little bit harder for everybody, and you make it a lot harder for the kind of people that everybody kind of agrees shouldn't have guns anyway. And I don't think that's a bad thing. Could it be even stronger and I'd still be happy with it? Yeah, probably. Do I think it's okay at the level that's being discussed? I'm not going to have a big objection to it. But then again, going to my final impact, will you have from this a noticeable impact on violent deaths in America? First of all, in order to even measure that, you're going to have to be years down the line. That's not something we're actually going to be able to tell this year. I suspect this kind of change will have some effect, but very minor. If what is being discussed now passes, I would be happy granting my prediction of something will pass, but something very watered down that probably won't have too much of an effect. It'll probably be overwhelmed by other things. I don't have the reference in front of me, but there was a number of good articles a couple months ago about the effect of lead on violence and growing evidence that the downturn in violent death and other violence in American society and across societies across the globe correlates incredibly strongly with the reduction of lead in the environment. Lead paints, lead gasoline, whatever. Studies that have shown, for instance, that when different states or different countries started reducing lead at different times, the drop in violence matched almost exactly with that change, with a bit of a delay, because it affects people in childhood exposure affects people when they're adults. And I find that fascinating, because if you actually look at the trend for gun deaths in the United States, well, not even gun deaths, if the trend for violent death in the U.S. has been declining regularly and consistently for decades now. And the thing it correlates most to is actually lead in the environment. And I find that absolutely fascinating and kind of cool. And it may be that this kind of playing around with gun laws in the end is a secondary effect. And that kind of sort of, hey, let's clean up the environment and make sure we aren't exposing our children to lead has an effect that overwhelms that. But anyway, I'm not going to object to this change just because I feel like a more car-like regulation of guns is quite reasonable. But in the end, it should be judged by its effectiveness. It's just, it's going to take a long time for that to even be clear. But in the meantime, I'm going to start repeating myself. This is fairly watered down. If anything passes at all, it's going to be a lot more symbolic than actually, quote-unquote, doing anything that's going to have a direct effect, I don't think. And it's, you know, it's probably close to the line where the negative effects of the additional government intervention and regulation are high enough that maybe it's right on the edge of sort of not being worth it from a cost-benefit perspective. But I'm still going to give it the benefit of the doubt at this point. But that should be the final judgment in the end. Anyway, let's have it done with this topic. Let's take another break and we'll come back and see if there's anything else to talk about. We'll be back after this. And here I am. So, we're probably only going to do 3 segments today, not 4. I have to get up and get ready and get my son to daycare, get myself to work, all that stuff shortly. It's Pacific time. It's just about 7:30 in the morning as I'm recording this. 14:30 UTC, mind you. Damn this cold cough thing. Let's talk about North Korea for a minute, and then we'll see if I want to throw in anything else before the end of the show. You know, we talked about this last week and talked about how, you know, they're blustering and they always bluster this, and no one really believes they'll really do anything. And if they did, it would be like a national suicide pact. And, you know, what's really going on here? And I must say, though, this really does seem to be a more intense version of this than I remember. I mean, there was a news alert this morning, and let me see if I can pull it up real quick. Here it is from the breaking news Twitter account. North Korea threatens nuclear attack on Tokyo in event of war, or if Japan shoots down a missile. You know, really? Okay. And there have been continuous threats for essentially the last 2 or 3 weeks. There's been an increase in the military posture from North Korea. They're putting missile launchers on alert. They've, of course, talked about actually going, you know, directly taking things to the American homeland. Meanwhile, I've heard reports from South Korea where the South Koreans are still like, yeah, we're not worried. They bluster all the time. But this does seem to be at a different level than it has been before. I've seen other reports about China getting increasingly annoyed at North Korea for doing all this and, you know, wanting to get them to, you know, back down. The U.S. did take some measures where they canceled some events where they thought it would ratchet up the tension even more. So the U.S. has backed down a little bit in terms of actions that might be perceived as provocative. But North Korea is still at it. And they warned foreigners to leave South Korea because the war might be imminent. I'm starting to wonder if they'll actually do something. And then the question is, how big does it blow up? I mean, Yvonne and I, when we talked last week, basically, there goes my alarm, basically said, look, if they did do something, if they actually did, you know, nuke a city or something like that, we'd run right over them. But honestly, it is more complicated than that. I mean, the assumption has always been the North Korean regime would just fall apart pretty quickly. And maybe it would. But we should talk about worst case scenarios, too. The worst case scenario is the North Korean regime stays fairly intact, stays in control, musters their huge army, defends their territory, maybe even takes some offensive action against South Korea, and the Chinese decide that despite North Korea doing something that they wish they hadn't done, they're still going to defend North Korea. And because they don't want a unified Western Korea right on their borders either. And we get a real conflict on our hands because the U.S. wouldn't be able to not respond. You know, if North Korea actually nuked Tokyo, can you even imagine the, you know, there would be cry, the U.S. would absolutely positively be required to respond. And actually, in that case, you might even have a unified worldwide response there. Even China might say, you know, that was just over the line. They need to go. But imagine for a moment they didn't. How does the U.S. really respond? Sure, we could just nuke them back. We could hands off, hit a button, and make cities in North Korea disappear. But as Yvonne and I talked last week, we'd be eliminating, you know, we'd be killing lots of innocent civilians too. That had absolutely nothing to do with the decision to do this. Most likely disagreed with it. Most likely don't really like the regime anyway, but who would be caught in this crossfire. And yes, North Korea would have just done exactly that and killed massive numbers of civilians, etc. But would there actually be world backing for us to do the same? Sure, there would be, you know, all sorts of people would be calling for massive retaliation. But would there be really support for wiping out cities full of civilians, full of innocent people? Or would we actually be pressured to do a response that was aimed very directly at the North Korean leadership and making sure that that leadership was eliminated and replaced instead? And if so, how does that work? Sure, we can fire targeted drones here and there to try to decapitate the leadership, but is our intelligence good enough to do that well? Remember how long it took us to find Saddam Hussein after the invasion of Iraq. It's not like that can just happen the next day. And if we're going to do a land invasion to try to actually take over North Korea, that's a very significant mobilization. And the North Korean army is huge. And if they held together, again, these are a lot of big ifs, you know, because everybody, again, sort of expects that if push came to shove and there was an actual confrontation and the United States started a major phase of armed combat against North Korea, then that the North Korean government would just fall apart. But assuming that didn't happen, and we didn't use nukes, we're talking about a major, major conflict. So there's a huge range of possibilities here. And it all, there are so many variables in terms of what do the North Koreans actually do? Do the Chinese stay behind them? Does the North Korean government stay intact and stay in control? And, you know, on the good side of that equation, I shouldn't say good, but on the sort of rosier outlook scenario. The rosiest outlook, of course, being this is all bluster, North Korea doesn't do anything, and we move on, which is probably still the most likely outcome, but, you know, we're talking about some of the others. Aside from that, the rosiest scenario is that North Korea makes some sort of, let's go down the spectrum. The next is they make some sort of attack, but it's minor. They don't nuke a city or anything like that. They have another border skirmish. And we basically refuse to engage in an escalation based on that. Another is they try to do a major attack, but it's thwarted. Either the missile malfunctions on its own, or we shoot it down, or whatever. Which, again, probably the right response is a limited response. And then we start getting the scenarios where they actually cause damage, and then we have to respond, and North Korea falls apart. And then all the way at the other end of the spectrum is World War III. And the whole point of this is it's incredibly unstable. And there are a huge range of options of what could happen out of this. And it's like, really, North Korea, you're playing with this? You're gambling on something with this level of uncertainty and this level of unknowns, many of which result in certainly the end of your regime and possibly the obliteration of your country? Really? And so they obviously have made the calculation, and I don't buy into for a minute that we're talking about crazy people here. You know, this is calculated and they think they know what they're doing. They've obviously calculated that they think they can get some additional leverage by doing this kind of stuff. That this is a moment where they can get a positive result out of this. I frankly don't see that calculation. I don't see how any of this is positive for North Korea. Now, maybe on a purely internal basis, it is somehow strengthening the current regime by unifying public opinion and making the leadership seem stronger. And that's probably a lot of the motivation here. If you remember back to, again, the first Iraq War and the weapons of mass destruction and all that, what it turned out later is that the signs that the administration was selectively looking at that made them think that there were weapons of mass destruction were two things, really. One, there were a few sources that were just trying to manipulate the Americans into invading in the hopes that they would be able to take over once the invasion happened. But also, Saddam Hussein himself wanted to make it look as if he still had a weapons program, because that made him look stronger potentially to the Iranians, made him look stronger internally, whereas admitting that he'd completely given up and had disarmed after the first Gulf War and there was nothing going on anymore would make him look weak, would let his neighbors feel like they were in a better position against him, etc. So it was all a bluff. And his bluff wasn't even aimed at the Americans, really. His bluff was aimed at local concerns. But in the end, the result was the Americans believed it because they wanted to believe it, and so they invaded, and Saddam Hussein, of course, ended up dead. And so there may be a lot of that kind of thing here, too, where this is really intended for internal consumption inside North Korea. And all of the effects on the rest of the world getting nervous about this are just side effects. But one would think that while that would justify a lot of bluster, that wouldn't justify actual aggressive action, actual attacks on other countries, because then you have the negative consequence of the world reaction to that. But I guess you don't know. I guess that's all I have to say about North Korea until something happens or doesn't. It's interesting to watch it continue to play out. And hopefully they don't nuke anybody. Hopefully they don't attack anybody in any way. Because really, the results of that kind of thing are going to be not good. I mean, it's going to be a mess regardless of what comes out of that. So hopefully we back away from that cliff. We're almost in an hour, so I'm just going to wrap it up. But I did want to say one other thing. And there are a few other things on my list. There's a poll that came out on who believes various conspiracy conspiracy theories and what percentage of Americans believe various conspiracy theories. That was kind of interesting. There were some threads going on online about people talking about sort of their political origin story. And this was started by Oliver Willis, I guess, where people tell about how they got to the political position they're in now. What events in their childhood or young adulthood led them to end up with the political beliefs they have. And I think that's kind of interesting thing to think about. But I haven't actually thought about it enough to write it down or to be coherent about it. I do want to mention taxes real quick. The annual tax deadline is, of course, a few days away. Last weekend, Brandy and I actually sat down and did our taxes. And yeah, I know we probably should have done them in January or February, but we always wait till April. You know, we're getting a decent refund, which is great, better than writing a check, which I've had to do many years in the past. But I always end up frustrated with the process. Almost exclusively this year. You know, even though we have some investments, we have a house, we have some deductions, we have some children, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. We have a bunch of stuff that is, so it's not the 1040 EZ or whatever, where you just plop in your income and do some very simple math and out comes the answer. It's a little bit more complicated than that. But even so, every single thing that we put in, almost, but very close, came directly from a document that the government could easily have a copy of automatically. There were W-2s, there were 1099s, there were, which the government does have copies of, there were, what else? A couple other things, like, but for the most part, almost everything was automatically imported from various documents that exist and at financial institutions, employers, whatever. And in many cases, if not all cases, are copies already submitted to the government anyway. And click, 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 out pops the number at the end. There is no reason whatsoever that for most people, they should have to do anything here. This should be processed automatically. The government should say, hey, we've got all the documents we need. Assuming you don't file any amendments that let us know that something else is going on other than what we know about, here's your bill or here's your check. There should be none of this filing taxes for most people. And again, you know, there are people that have very complex tax situations and blah, blah, blah. And of course, they're always going to have to file something. But for the vast, vast, vast majority of people, there's none of that nonsense. Even if you've got kids and a house and investments and blah, 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 that stuff should just all flow out of the existing documentation and be done. And frankly, in places where people have quote unquote really complex, you know, investments, et cetera, et cetera. You know, that part of the tax law should just be freaking eliminated because most of the time it's actually deductions and things that people can get out of paying taxes for. Yeah, and it's just overly complex. Get rid of it. Make it as simple as possible. There's no reason anybody ever should have to actually file stuff. This should be fully automatic. So, and of course, you know, all the tax preparation businesses and such have extensive lobbyists that go against tax simplification. And of course, complex taxes are ways that everybody can sort of get their pet thing into the taxes. You get this deduction for this thing, you get this thing for that thing, and we want to do social engineering by encouraging people to have houses, so we put in a mortgage interest deduction. All kinds of things can be put into the tax code. Of course, the penalty for not having health care is now in the tax code. All kinds of, you know, making it complex allows more room for shenanigans, which, as far as I'm concerned, is another reason to make it as simple as possible. I acknowledge the fact that we need some form of taxes. I'm not an absolutist who thinks it's possible to eliminate taxes entirely, but I'm very much of the idea that they should be as simple, easy, painless as possible. Now, of course, you have the alternate. If it's too painless, then people stop even realizing they're doing it, and it gives more rooms for shenanigans in another way. But anyway, I get annoyed every year that I have to go through the process of clicking a bunch of buttons in TurboTax. Or actually, my wife did it this year and last year while I was sitting next to her. Going through the process of clicking a bunch of buttons and hitting submit. Because it's not like we actually had to pull all kinds of information together from all kinds of places and do things by hand and manually do calculations. We're past that. We use a program, and it pulls in all that information automatically from our financial institutions, from my employer, from whatever. There's no reason the government couldn't just do that themselves and be done with it. Anyway, rant over. Alex didn't join us today because he's asleep while I'm recording this, but I will say he's been using the voice recognition on the iPad more and more, so it's really cute. Like, he'll bring up YouTube, and he knows he wants a specific video, so he'll hit the little microphone and try to tell it what he wants. But of course, you know, it doesn't work all that great even for adults. For, you know, a three-year-old with a three-year-old voice and not fully articulating all the words in the way that, you know, voice recognition expects, it takes him a while, but he's very persistent. He'll be sitting there hitting the button and saying trains, trains, trains for like 15 minutes until it finally gets what he wants. And then he's very happy. But, or more complicated phrases like the train is going into the city, which is one video he's liked recently. Anyway, I just wanted to do that aside because it's cute and you didn't get to hear him talk this week. Anyway, let's call that a show. All kinds of other things happened. All kinds of other things also always happen, but not this week. We won't talk about it this week anyway. Hopefully, Yvonne will be back with us as normal next week. In the meantime, tell all your friends, tweet about us, share us on social media, email me at ablesmay@ablesmay.com if you have any questions, comments, or thoughts about anything we talked about that you want to share. You know, obviously, you don't have to tell me if you have thoughts and you don't want to share. But, you know, I encourage sharing. And I'll say especially dissenting views. If you think everything I said on this show today was bullshit, that's cool. Let us know. It helps engage the conversation. That's it. Goodbye. Enjoy your week. And listen again next week. Goodbye.